I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Donald Trump has more than 6 million Twitter followers and keeps them engaged by tweeting something like a dozen times a day. Earlier this week, he used his Twitter account to rail against his critics in the Republican Party. How do you fight millions of dollars of fraudulent commercials pushing for crooked politicians, he asked. I'll be using Facebook and Twitter. Watch. Bernie Sanders has been called the king of social media and has many enthusiastic fans who produce clever internet memes. Back in the 20th century, radio and then television transformed presidential campaigns, and now it looks like social media is doing the same in this century. Our topic for today's Radio Times. Joining us by Skype is Nicholas Carr, author of several books on technology and culture, including The Swallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and also a forthcoming book called Utopia is Creepy. He's a contributor to Politico, The Wall Street Journal, The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. Nicholas Carr, nice to have you with us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Bruce Hardy. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Strategic Communication. That's at Temple University. He's also a distinguished research fellow with the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg Public Policy Center. And Bruce Hardy, nice to have you with us on Radio
Thank
Times.
You. Thank you.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests, we have Ken Winnick, and he's the managing director of survey research at the Annenberg Public Policy Center, also a lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication, teaches a course on new media and politics. Ken Winnick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure to be here.
Nicholas, let me begin with you. Do you think the angry, even frustrated mood of the electorate has gotten magnified by social media?
I think it has. I mean, I think the medium of social media is well suited to very provocative statements that kind of cut through the welter of messages and information people tend to gather all day long. So I don't think the media in and of itself causes what we're seeing necessarily, but I do think that the campaign starts to shape itself to the dominant media or to the new medium, and things like Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat are what's new this year. They've really reached a kind of critical mass with people, and they are, I think, shaping the tenor and the tone of the campaign.
Ken, how far back do we have to go to identify, I guess, the start of social media used by political people running for office?
Well, social media in the new technology sense, really the 2008 campaign was the Facebook campaign, and the Obama campaign used it very well, and their number of Facebook followers far exceeded those of John McCain. And, but it wasn't just Facebook. It was using blogs, the existing technologies, and the internet to mobilize, sign people up, and the Facebook was used to sign people up to join the campaign. So, in 08, a social media. I mean, Howard Dean in 2004 really started the foundation of using the internet to raise money and mobilize people and to get people involved from the bottom up. You know, campaigns are typically run top down, but what Dean did and what Obama carried over, and we see more today, is a bottom up campaign where you're trying to get people involved and feel like they can make a difference. And that was the success of the Obama campaign in 2008.
Well, Bruce, I think everyone today, rightly or wrongly, feels like they're an expert. Everyone's a pundit, aren't they not?
Well, everyone's a pundit. Well, everyone has the ability to retweet, right? So, or repost something on Facebook. And a lot of people use Facebook as a news source, and it's also it's their news aggregator. So it's easy for a quick clip to come through that catches my eye, that's funny. Hey, also, I'm angry about the future of the United States, so I'm going to pass on what Donald Trump is saying and retweet it. And that allows me to kind of give myself a voice in a way.
Well, I wonder, picking up on that, Nicholas Carr, about things like Facebook and Twitter, maybe even Google, are they running the conversation here if people have to use those to get their message out?
They're certainly, I think they are driving the conversation. So even though obviously radio and TV and newspapers still play in a very important role, more and more the entire media system is kind of reacting to what's going on Twitter, what Donald Trump tweeted this morning and so forth. And I think one thing we have to realize is on the the good part about this is, yes, it kind of leads to more democratization and gives people a voice, however meager that voice may be. But there are formal constraints on all of these social media. So you're allowed to retweet or comment or interact in what I would call a fairly superficial way. And I think what that tends to do is create a kind of echo chamber in which very provocative statements, very kind of tendentious statements get circulated very, very quickly. But that doesn't mean that people are wrestling with deep issues, complex issues, as I think everyone would wish they would, a little bit more at least.
Well, Ken, I'm looking at you, and it's true. What is provocative, what's controversial, that's what gets attention.
Right. And what Nicholas is saying is, you know, there is a provocative tweet, and all of a sudden, all the journalists who, you know, live on Twitter, they see it, and then they say, oh, this is now the important thing. Let's spend our news cycle covering it. And then what else might be more important gets pushed to the wayside. So
is that new, do you think, or just that everything is kind of hyperspeed today?
It's new-ish. It's, you know, it's been getting there, you know, and yes, I do think the internet had something to do with it. But right now, yes, with Twitter and you know, Facebook, but mainly Twitter, it gets out there very quickly. The news cycle is boom, 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 and you know, that's something we're seeing as a result.
I was thinking about this, and I mentioned Donald Trump in my introduction. I'll put this to you, Bruce, and he really fumbled an answer recently about the KKK. Mm-hmm. It was an interview that was on television, person to person, live, and then he tweeted, you know, I disavow.
Sure.
And I was saying to myself, now, does that count? I mean, does disavowing something on Twitter, is that the same thing as saying that on television to a, you know,
well,
to
a
human audience,
I mean,
you know what I mean?
I guess it depends on who's the judge of who, if it counts or not, right? So some people who are anti-Trump will definitely say, no, this is not correct. He is not denouncing the KKK. Those who are for him or might say, well, there he is right there. So they can point to that.
Right.
So it is an easy kind of – and what we've been talking about here too is this kind of echo chamber, like this filter bubble too, where people can retweet that, look, he's disavowed the KKK, so see, he's not a racist or whatever arguments you want to make from disavowing the KKK or not. So that's – in a way, it depends. It's mm-hmm. hard to say, is it count or not? It depends on who's counting, I guess.
Do you have thoughts on that, Nicholas?
Well, it seems to count to Trump's followers, and
exactly.
And I think what we're seeing is a loss of what we used to call narrative in the media coverage of campaigns, and TV imposed this kind of storyline, this continuing storyline on campaigns, where you'd have the daily news cycle that would follow through a few days. So if there was a gaffe, as Trump's KKK episode would have been treated, that would have continued on for a few days. People would have debated it. Trump would have been forced probably to apologize in a more, in a deeper way. But that doesn't happen anymore. And I think the media still expects those narratives to play out. And yet they kind of – something happens. Trump sends out a tweet. The story goes away and we move on to the next tweet.
Or everyone gathers around the tweet and then drops the other stories that they might be dealing with. We were talking about narrative before going on the air, Bruce.
Yes. And I guess along what Nick is saying is that there's also, because the news cycle is so quick now, it's instantaneous, right? So someone can create news instantly by creating a tweet. And with horse race coverage, where it's more he said, she said, and people are just kind of being spectators of the democratic process, I think what happens is there's so much happening that we don't have time to take a single event or some sort of complication like this disavowing of the KKK and really analyze it, because something else has happened. Another debate has happened. Something outlandish has happened. Trump got up and gave his acceptance speech, or not acceptance speech, but his victory speech saying thank you with his steaks and his water or whatever. And so that's news. And now we have to talk about that. And then tomorrow, tonight there's another debate. That's going to be news. And so we'll have to talk about that. And then news cycle is so quick. We don't have time to sit down and have these complex kind of discussions that we need to have for people to make correct votes.
Well, Ken, it's interesting. You get 140 characters with Twitter,
right.
You can talk to anyone in the world, so that you know, that expands whoever you might be talking to, but it limits the conversation because you're working within 140 characters.
That's right, and that's the problem. You know, that's why that's why, you know, we're seeing these statements that are provocative, because you have to get your point in there quickly. Or, you know, most of the tweets that I follow, say mainly from journalists, are usually links. So it's like, check out, you know, this story on, and then you go to the link and you get more information. But if you're giving an opinion tweet, you have only 140 characters to say it, and Donald Trump has mastered that, mm-hmm. you know, master of the nastier tweets, but he gets attention with what he says.
Nick, you've written about how radio, you know, I'm dating myself here, but, you know, back to the 20th century, how radio influenced campaigns. And then, of course, television came in. And now if we have this internet or social media that we're dealing with. Is this just kind of a natural evolution that we're talking about here?
Well, I don't think it's a natural evolution, because it's completely the media is, you know, artificial and man-made and so forth. But I do think it echoes what we've seen before. You had radio come along, and probably the 1924 race, I think, is where it reached maturity. And suddenly the campaigns changed and candidates changed. And you had to be able to speak to people in kind of an intimate way, because they were gathered around the radio in their living room. And we saw something similar in the 1960 race between Nixon and Kennedy. Suddenly you had to project an image of yourself, a visual image of yourself. Kennedy was very good at it. Nixon wasn't in that campaign. And so these kind of, we've seen in the past how a new media can very much change the conversation, change what we expect from politicians. And so at that level, I think this is kind of the third big change in modern campaign.
For better, for ill, or this, I mean, this is how we communicate with each other anyway, Ken?
That's right. And, you know, I ask my students every semester that I teach, you know, where they get their information. And no one gets their information from traditional news sources, at least newspapers. Nobody reads the newspaper anymore. Nobody watches television anymore. Everything is online, and it's either through Facebook or through some other, you know, third party, be it something like The Skim, which is a newsletter that appeals to younger women. You can't predict where people are getting it. And that's why, again, not to mention a third time, but echo chambers and mm-hmm. silos and people tend to go towards that news or information site that best fits their political ideology.
Nothing new about that, though, is it?
I think it's been getting more and more that way, you know.
One of the things, too, is that there's kind of their search engine optimizers. And so there are actually algorithms that will say, well, you like a lot of this type of news content. So when you go search something, you're going to get news content that's similar to that. So there is some work that's done on kind of this idea of filter bubbles that's actually being automated for you. So you get the information that's mm-hmm. But I want to say,
based on your track record
and your cookies and everything else they know about you, all the data that they have on you.
Hold on to that thought, sure. Only because they're playing my song. We have to take a very short break, talking with Bruce Hardy, Ken Winnig, and Nicholas Carr about social media, the effect of social media on campaigns, the presidential campaign, and on the press that covers the campaign. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and I'm talking to Bruce Hardy. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Strategic Communication. That's at Temple University. Also with us, Ken Winnig. He's the managing director of survey research. That's at the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And also with us, Nicholas Carr, author of several books on technology and culture. He's got a new one coming out called Utopia is Creepy. And he's also been a contributor to Politico, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Bruce, I had to interrupt you right before the break. Go ahead.
I was just going to discuss that there are some positives to this. We seem to be talking a lot about those negatives, but there are some positives, and there's some positives of getting people engaged that maybe would not be normally engaged. For example, Bernie Sanders has his dank meme stash that has 300,000 followers, I think. I might get that number a little bit wrong, on Facebook. But those are young adults who are getting engaged in the democratic process in a way by making these kind of funny memes, but it shows an interesting new evolution of a new technology actually getting people more engaged anyway.
Do you agree with that, Nicholas?
Absolutely. I think on the one hand, you can say that if if a certain group of people, and I think this is true, is getting all their information and all their news basically through their phones, then kind of to reach those people, you have to go, whether it's good or bad, you have to go through that medium. And also, you know, I think Bruce is right that it is engaging people in provoking in sometimes a passionate commitment to political issues or political candidates that among people that would have otherwise be disengaged or disenfranchised by the whole process. So I do think there are certainly very good parts of this, and on the other hand, there are not so good parts.
I mean, Ken, I personally, I love having in my pocket or my purse my smartphone, and I'm hooked up. You know, sure. I can be almost anywhere, and I'm hooked up, and you know, whether engaging in the world or watching the world engage over these issues.
Yes, and that's, you know, it's the good thing and the bad thing is, are we too engaged, too much information? But it's there, and every campaign, going back to the early campaigns, to the radio campaigns even, it's, you want to get people engaged. You want to get people to be part of you, to and you know, what we saw, what we're seeing now with Bernie Sanders and the memes, you know, we saw with Facebook, and we saw with Twitter and with the Republican in Congress in 2010. So the key is to get people engaged, and how you do it, you know, that's the what every campaign is looking for.
Well, one way to get engaged is to watch the debates. There was one last night. There's going to be one tonight. Mm-hmm. And we were talking, Ken, about your own experience even last night. And, you know, we do shows about it. So I'm watching and I'm online and right. I'm checking out blogs and tweets and things like that.
You're like a lot of people. When right. we're watching the debates, we have our handheld or on Facebook or
all of the above.
And, you know, you want to see what the immediate reaction is from everybody else about something that one of the candidates had said. And you say, I agree with that. Or, ooh, that might be true. You know, we have organizations like factcheck.org or PolitiFact that are fact checking in real time. You want to see, is that true what they just said? And you will find that out. But the other thing is you can be distracted. You can miss something. A study that that Bruce and I and a couple other co-authors, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, Jeffrey Gottfried, and Lance Holbert, are doing, will be out in April, looked at you know, what people learn while watching debates. And people who watch debates do learn, regardless of whether you're using a handheld or watching it without a handheld. But those who are distracted with a handheld tend to learn at a lower rate. Hmm. So this distraction may not be a good thing.
And the definition of learning is finding out something you didn't know before.
That's right. I mean, the way we did it, we asked people after the debate in a panel study, you know, knowledge about certain stances and issues that the candidates have, and we tied that in with whether they watched the debate and whether they followed it on a social media application.
Nick, does that make sense to you?
It does, but I want to pick up on this issue of distraction that happens, because I think it's a very important one. And I think one of the big differences that we're seeing with social media is that other media, TV, radio, print, they isolated to a degree. They isolated political news, campaign news. So you would watch a program or listen to a program about politics or read a story about politics. With social media, there's no separate stream for political news in Facebook or in Twitter or in Snapchat. So the political messages, the campaign messages, are kind of stream at you alongside all these other messages that you're getting through social media from your friends, from celebrities, from whatever. And I think that is one of the reasons that we see, I would say, more superficial, more pointed, more cutting kind of messages coming through, because politicians, in order to compete with all that other information, they have to be provocative. They have to say something that's going to get your temporary focus rather than focusing on, you know, a YouTube clip or something. And this is a new dynamic in political discourse, I think, and we're just kind of adapting to it.
And a cat video certainly helps. It doesn't always fit into a political campaign. Bruce, let me turn to you. And we were talking before going on the air about examples of people on television that seem to be using this medium in an interesting and provocative kind of way, provocative in the best sense of the word kind of way.
So one of the things that we see a lot, especially in our kind of entertainment politics, I guess, is what you would call, but specifically John Oliver. So one of the things that he does is he always has a call to action that kind of engages in some sort of social media. So recently he had a call to turn Trump to Drump. And at the end of the show, he said, go to this hashtag, and he has a hashtag. And then the last week, he reintroduced a hashtag again. So he's using it. And the video, the YouTube video, just I was looking this morning, had 20 million views.
Wow.
But again, we don't know who's viewing, knows where they are. Are these voters, or are they just people who just really like John Oliver? He has a certain special, you know, a certain audience that's going to watch him, and there's a lot of people that don't watch him. So it's you don't know how broad that's getting out. But it is interesting, this call to action, this satirical activism that he's doing.
But before that, there's usually 10 minutes of a kind of wonky but also clever, sometimes funny analysis of an issue that doesn't get a lot of attention. And then you add the hashtag on the end.
Exactly.
Right?
And in 2012 campaign, we saw Stephen Colbert have his super PAC. And the way he did that was he went through the whole process of making his own super PAC. And through the use of narrative and humor, it caught people's attention. So people like things that are funny because it's unexpected. And that's why what makes things go viral is videos that are unexpected. So once you have the unexpectedness, it gets attention. And then people will pay attention, they'll engage with it, and they'll actually start learning it. And we did a study, the same group of co-authors, where we saw that Stephen Colbert did better than any other news source in teaching the public about super PACs and campaign finance.
That's very interesting. Ken, you want to add something to that?
First of all, John Oliver's on HBO. HBO is a subscription-based service, which doesn't have a lot of viewers. But because of this campaign going viral, not only were there 20 million views on YouTube, there are over 64 million views of the story, which linked to a video on Facebook. So people are paying attention, and they're not necessarily the main viewers of his show, but things like that do go viral.
And does that mean if people are paying attention, they're saying, oh, I didn't know this about Donald Trump or Donald Trump? I mean, they're saying, oh, I didn't realize about Trump University or
perhaps,
the other things.
Yeah, perhaps. And, you know, I've read that he sold out he made hats that said, make Donald Trump again. And he sold out of those hats. They had to order more. And there was something called a Drumfinator, or that's been downloaded 400,000 times.
One of the interesting things about that, though, that's a 21-minute video. So to keep – and then YouTube tracks a completed view. It's not just clicked on at once. So that's a long time to keep an attention of somebody. And that's very interesting.
Yeah. I'd be curious, Nick, what you think of that.
Well, I would – I'm not sure it's making much of a difference, to be honest. I mean, I think it's great that we're having – lots of voices talk about this. It seems to me that, that John Oliver's is speaking to the choir, that what we have is a huge amount of polarization. We've had this for a long time, but particularly on social media, so that if it's an anti-Trump hashtag, it's going to be seen by anti-Trump people, and it's going to reinforce their view of Trump. It's going to be completely ignored, if not missed entirely, by Trump supporters. And I think things like hashtags, the way we organize information online, more and more plays to a polarized electorate where people are able to hear what they want to hear and ignore what they don't want to hear.
Let me quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Nicholas Carr. He writes about technology and culture. He's a contributor to Politico, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. Ken Winnick from the Annenberg Public Policy Center with us as well. And Bruce Hardy, an assistant professor in the Department of Strategic Communication at Temple University. We're talking about the role of social media, of Twitter, and other forms of social media when it comes to this particular presidential campaign, and also how the news media has been covering the campaign. And again, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Bruce, do you think that the news media has to sort of always hurry to catch up with whatever is being sent out across social
media? Sure, of course.
Media?
I mean, I think that's one of the things that especially that journalism schools are teaching today is you better very be well-versed in social media platforms. And not just Facebook and Twitter, but now talking Snapchat and Instagram and newer ones. Peaches is a new one that just came
out. What's that? Peaches.
It's a new one that just came out. I just saw it. It's supposed to be the best social media. So I signed up for it. Nobody else is on it yet. But, you know, there's
always... This is the world we live in.
But that's the world we live in. And that's one thing that as campaign strategists and people who are communication specialists, they're always thinking of how can we use the next new technology to reach the people that we need to reach.
But we, you know, I'm going to sound like an old fuddy-duddy here, but we live in a complicated world. We've got big, complicated problems. I think we all know what they are. And is social media can designed to help us understand, walk through some of those problems, whether it's immigration or tax policy or foreign policy?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
It's designed, but it depends on how we react to it and where we go to get our answers. And we could Google something. Or we can follow, somebody on social media or see what your friends are reposting or retweeting. But that may be information that, again, fits a certain ideology or a certain way of thinking. So, you know, the question is the information they're getting the truthful or factual information, or does it just, you know, reinforce their own thoughts?
I mean, there are facts out there, right?
Yes, there are. Although this
it's
campaign
not like they disappeared.
Yeah, this campaign, you know, the fact-checking organizations have been working very hard to keep up, and it's been very difficult because I think, you know, I don't have numbers on it, but there's probably a lot more deception in what's been said in these campaigns than in campaigns past.
So the question, do these fact-check organizations, do they have an impact? Or, again, does it go to the segmented audience that's going to believe or not believe based on what they believe in the first place?
Well, that's, I think, the challenge with fact-checking organizations. Some campaigns will use fact-checking organizations for their own benefit. They'll cite it if a fact-checker has come out and said that their opponent has said something that's deceptive, or they'll say, no, they're biased one way or the other because they've called something that I said, or they'll just completely ignore it. Mm. But their fact-checking is very important, and we need to have it out there so that to keep the candidates honest and to try to inform the electorate and the public as best we can about what is really factual and what is not.
Chris, you want to add Nicholas, you want to add to that?
Well, I would – you know, I'd like to come back to that question of, you know, are these media, are social media designed to encourage deep engagement with political issues and complex issues? And I think they're not at all. They're designed for the opposite. I mean, when Mark Zuckerberg created Facebook or when Twitter was created, no one was thinking about let's create this medium for political discussions. They were creating it for banter between friends, for loose conversations. Nothing deep, nothing that required too much attention. And suddenly we've had to say, well, we're going to put political discourse through these media that were designed for something completely different. And I think they actually, for all the good things they do in terms of engagement, I don't think they promote any kind of deep thinking about the complexities of issues. So I think they're actually, as media, I don't think they're very well suited to politics and campaigning, but they're there and that's what they're being used for.
But do you think it's harmful in that people maybe have this idea that they are either learning something or involved in a process and perhaps it's a more superficial involvement, Nick?
I do think you can kid yourself that by retweeting brief messages from whoever, Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or whatever, I think you can kid yourself that you're engaged in a political discussion. In some cases, therefore, it does make it kind of too easy for people to get the illusion that they're engaged, even though they're engaged at a very, very superficial level. And I don't think that's true of everyone. I think some people follow links and go deeper. But I do think there's this illusion of engagement that we have with social media.
You want to add to that, Bruce?
Yeah, that's been that idea that kind of been around for a while. Back in the early 50s, sociologists came up with something called the narcotizing dysfunction of media, where people feel that they're being engaged when they're actually not, but just by reading the news, they go, look at me, I'm reading news, I'm part of the political process. Mm-hmm. However, one thing with social media also kind of allows is for deception to travel quite quickly, and people blindly kind of taking on deception because it's in a way it's getting vetted. So my best friend sends me something,
right,
or reposts something to me, or it's in their news feed. Well, that's kind of been vetted in a way by my best friend, so I will take that as a, you know, more truthful than if it's coming from somebody else. So there's this interesting way of how the kind of notions of objectivity and vetting in kind of mainstream media that kind of falls away in this social media, and so you can have a lot of deceptive claims flying around in media, and it's no one's really picking up on those either.
Do you agree with that, Ken?
Yeah, no, I do. And I want to also echo, you know, what Nicholas is saying, that yes, there's a lot of superficial political discourse, and the point I was making is that it is out there. The ability to do it is there, but perhaps Facebook itself was not designed, and Twitter, certainly with 140 characters, there's not much discourse that can really happen while you're on there.
But I'm thinking, we're almost up on a break here, but I'm thinking about the promise of the internet, you know, that
there are many promises.
I mean, and some have been delivered, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we can learn about the world where, you know, you're not stuck in your house if you want to know about what's going on.
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, there are pitfalls too, and we've seen the pitfalls. We've seen digital divides. We've seen, you know, well, the discourse that we were promised really turns into, you know, devolutions of arguments. If you look at the comments in stories, the first two comments may make sense, and then the third one you're being called a name, and then, you know, what's the Godwin's rule that goes into effect that you're called a Nazi after about 20 comments. So, yeah, there's promises and there are pitfalls.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Ken Winnick from the Annenberg Public Policy Center, Bruce Hardy from Temple University joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, and also with us, Nicholas Carr, writes about technology and culture, author of several books, a contributor to a number of news sites. And we are talking about the internet and how the internet, social media, is influencing this political campaign and the press that covers it. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When a presidential candidate makes a gaffe or an outrageous statement, we don't have to wait around to see if it's going to appear on the nightly news. We're going to know about it right away because of Twitter and the growing number of social media outlets. They do provide a steady, sometimes overwhelming stream of information from the campaign trail. That also goes for the press that covers the candidates. And in this hour of the show, how social media is changing political campaigns. And again, we have a trio of guests, Bruce Hardy, Ken Winnig, and Nicholas Carr. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a Facebook comment from Paula. She says, regarding John Oliver's segment on Trump's failed businesses, don't you think Mitt Romney's speech a couple of days later drew exactly on that? So I guess, and you were talking about that, Bruce, the kind of influence that something like that can have, or, well, maybe it's just a coincidence.
I mean, I'm sure there's people that are monitoring. So I'm sure for all the campaigns and all the political actors, there's just people who sit there and monitor everything and get the environment. And now that you see that the Oliver video was trending, it probably did add to, or at least it kind of peaked maybe, or reinforced some of the arguments that Mitt Romney was saying against Trump.
Nick, during the break, we were talking about the comment sections, and frankly, for me anyway, it gets kind of depressing after the third or fourth comment is posted about the issue at hand. Then it seems to devolve into a lot of finger pointing, and before you know it, someone's being called a Nazi. How did that happen, or is that just the world we live in?
I think it's human nature, unfortunately.
Right.
There was a lot of idealized thinking about how the internet would open up conversation and people would expose themselves to different points of view. And this, by the way, is, we hear this with every new medium. We heard it with television, with radio, because there's this view that anytime you expand our ability to get information or to communicate, we'll become better citizens and we'll reach out and expand our horizons. Unfortunately, in many cases, the more information we get, the more we reinforce our own opinions and our own biases. And we see that in comment strands. And by the way, some comments are really, really good.
Absolutely.
But it does tend to become very polarized and to devolve into name calling over time. And, you know, as I say, I think that's a lot of that is about human nature and the way we tend to argue when we don't see the person we're arguing with.
A kind of mob mentality, do you think, Nick?
I do think it is that. And I do think social media, as I mentioned, through its kind of formal aspects, things like hashtags, and these are, you know, these are good things in many ways, but they do tend to provide a platform for a kind of mob action or mob thinking.
Can you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things we saw actually last night in the debate, the Univision debate, there was a hashtag that came out called Hispandering, which means that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were accused of pandering to the Hispanic audience. And I was looking at the Twitter government, which follows the trends of what's talked about and Google Trends, showed that there was a 4,000% spike in Hispandering, the term. So that's the first time we saw it.
Right.
That came from that debate, and that's typical of what we see. You know, like in 2012 when Mitt Romney talked about binders full of women, that sort of spiked as well, and there were memes that came from that. You know, everything ranging from Hillary Clinton sitting there with the BlackBerry in her sunglasses saying, who still uses binders, you know, and these are, you know, what comes out of it.
Well, and there was a lot of humor. I mean, that's a good example, and cleverness even of making new words and turning things into hashtags and having fun, I think, to some degree. You agree with that, Bruce?
Yeah, I do. But at the same time, going back to the name calling, what's interesting is that it is human nature, but we are seeing it now actually on the debate stage, which is kind of, I think, has been unprecedented, especially the last Democratic debate where there was a
last night?
No.
The Republican
debate. Sorry, excuse
ago.
Me. Yeah, a week ago.
There are a lot of them.
And, you know, with the name calling, like little Marco and those kind of things that I don't think we've ever seen before, at least at that level.
Is that because of social media?
I don't know if it is social media or not. I don't know if social media causes changes in culture or is a reflection of changes in culture. I don't think we can answer that question.
You nodded your head, Ken.
No, I agree with it's we're not saying social media blames it, but it could be more reflective, and I agree with Bruce on that.
I mean, Nick, it seems like some candidates, you know, have mastered the world of Twitter. Some have even said are act as trolls when it comes to Twitter as well. Do you agree with that analysis?
I certainly think that some candidates are better at using social media than others. And I think we see it in one thing that happens when a new medium comes along is that a lot of candidates, particularly establishment candidates, keep playing by the old rules. Mm-hmm. So don't really adapt their messages and their campaign to the new medium. And I think we saw that with somebody like Jeb Bush, who I think was still thinking in terms of television campaigns. And I have to project this establishment image. And meanwhile, Trump was tearing him apart with little tweets and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it provided a moment that showed that candidates who don't adapt to the changes in media often find themselves very quickly kind of out of the conversation. And that's not necessarily a good thing, but I think it's the reality.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about that clip when he was still running. I think he was in New Hampshire and had to encourage the people he was talking to to clap. And that, you know, how many times did you see that on television?
Right. And those are the types of things that could, you know, put your campaign under when something like that, and it gets played over and over again. And I think Jeb Bush, I mean, he did attempt to use you know, new media as much as he could. Certainly, I saw his presence online quite a bit, but he just couldn't, you know, he had a lot of things going against him. Mm. And Trump was certainly not a positive in his attempt to get the nomination.
A comment from Am. She says, it's interesting that this conversation in itself has been a form of advertising for Trump. Perhaps they don't realize how many times Trump has been inadvertently mentioned. Not too many other candidates have even been mentioned in this conversation. And Nick, I mean, you know, I hear this, and there's always that question about how do you cover someone who is the front runner among the Republicans, who seems to break all the rules, and since we're talking about social media in this hour, and seems to have mastered social media as well. I mean, is it the person that we dare not say his name?
Well, it's very hard to talk about how social media is changing politics and changing the campaign without talking about Trump a lot, because he kind of, for better or for worse, has been the most aggressive user of Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, as you said at the top of the program, he said, a couple of days ago, he right. tweeted that he's going to counter all the TV advertising through Facebook and Twitter. So it is, you know, it is unfortunate maybe that he's so prominent in these types of discussions, but he's the one who is kind of pioneering this mm-hmm. new use of a new medium.
Ken, you want to add to that?
I mean, up until this campaign, it was all about how much money you can raise and spend, you know, super PACs now and 501c4s supporting these candidates and the campaigns themselves. You know, those campaigns that spent the most money tended to do well. Well, Donald Trump says he spent only $25 to $30 million against a Jeb Bush who spent $130 million. And that's why we have to look at it in a different way than we have in the past.
Do you think, Bruce, that social media is really supplanting the kind of ads that candidates and campaigns have to spend so much time and money funding?
I don't know if it's supplanting, or it's definitely playing a larger role as each election goes on. And the reason is because of the mobile aspect of it, right? So. You're waiting in line at the bank. You look at a line at a bank. What do they do? They're all looking at their phone. And most of the time, they're opening up Facebook to see what's happening as a time killer. Mm-hmm. And so instead of having this kind of uses, like I want to go use media to learn, they are actually sitting there wasting time and, oh, there's something from the campaign. Let me click on that. Or here's another thing from the campaign. Let me click on that. So in a way, they have a lot more chances to get information from the campaigns to the electorate.
What do you think, Nick?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when we move into the general campaign after the parties have made their choices, because I think primaries, particularly when you have a lot of candidates, tend to be noisy by their nature, and that plays to social media and people are only sporadically paying attention. Once we get to a nationwide campaign, it'll be interesting to see, and I can't predict it, how much – whether the dynamics will change and move back more toward TV advertising and big money and away from social media, or whether social media will continue to play as big a role as it's been playing. I don't know, but I think it's going to be – it'll tell us a lot about how campaigns are changing and how they're not changing.
I'd be curious. Ken, it looks like you wanted to add something to that.
Well, what will be interesting is, you know, I think this campaign, both sides, the Democratic side and the Republican side, have received so much attention. I don't know what the viewership has been in for all these debates, but I know it's over 150 million if you total them. So the question is, how many minds need to be persuaded or changed? I mean, yes, the challenge will be if Trump gets the nomination, what will the Republican Party that's saying, oh no, we really can't nominate him, what will they do? And on the Democratic side, If Hillary gets the nomination, everything will be moved towards getting the Sanders supporters and vice versa. But I'm just curious to see how much movement there really will be and how much effect there can be. Will people have made up their mind by September 1st or November 3rd?
Usually before that.
I mean, there are very few undecided voters anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, studies have shown that there are very few. You know, that's why we're seeing the campaigns we do where everybody's trying to hit the base.
And keep the base engaged, involved. Right. Do you think, Bruce, does this kind of social media engagement, does that lead to voter participation? And by that, does it mean that people are going to go and vote for these candidates?
Not at all, because if Ben Carson has 5.7 over 5 million Facebook followers, and he wasn't getting the vote. So you can't bank on that, I don't think. And in the end, when it comes to the general election, when you have, you know, your two-party system, you have a handful of voters that you that they're really looking at, and that's where the advertising will come in, like handful of swing states. You know, you're not going to spend advertising in Texas or California or New York. You're going to spend in the swing states and getting those people who are kind of swing voters, and that's a very small sliver of the electorate, and that's where advertising does play a part, where you can go and target, especially through all the targeting techniques that they have through cable and other platforms. That's where we'll see advertising, kind of traditional advertising, coming back and playing a role that it has been traditionally.
Did you want to add to that, Ken?
No, just the key is, you know, advertising kind of has the effect at the margins, and that's what Bruce was saying. Yeah.
So, Nick, what makes Utopia so creepy? Title of your new book, Utopia is Creepy.
Well, whenever you see depictions of utopia, it always what makes life interesting, I think, is things like conflict and emotions and messiness. And utopias always clean those things up and end up making life feel very kind of robotic and artificial. And I think we're in a phase where we constantly look to technology to kind of clean up all the messes that are naturally come about in human society. And I don't think we think so clearly about the unappetizing aspects of cleaning everything up and looking to technology to solve all our problems.
Ken, to all three of you, actually, I'm thinking, so we had radio. I mean, we still have radio, obviously. Yeah, yeah. We have television. Now we're talking about social media. So what's next? I mean, what's the next tool that people are going to have, Ken? Or do we know?
Well, if I knew that, I would be. But
I mean, Google Glass tried to do immersive technology, right?
Oh, with the glasses.
So you're just constantly connected all the time.
And but that didn't work out, did it?
That didn't work out. And then supposedly virtual reality is going to be supposedly the next big thing. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think immersive technology is really and you know, smart technology. So when you're walking down the street, you have your glasses on, something's going to pop out, and it'll be advertising specifically to you. So the micro-targeting that we have with the big data kind of revolution that's going on in terms of knowing everything about every single person and using that to make kind of, you know, pitches towards these people that are so personalized. So I think immersive technology is really what we're going to be seeing as the next big thing.
What do you think, Ken? Immersive technology makes sense to you?
Well, like I said, I don't want to go on a limb and say what the next thing is because I don't have a good idea, but you know, I'm sure it'll be very interesting.
Well, as you look, Nick, into our utopian future, how do you see, I guess, the next form of communication?
Yes, it'll be so immersive that you'll be able to actually taste those Trump steaks rather than looking at them.
Right.
I don't know. I would guess for a while it's going to be more of the same. I think, you know, we're in a time where kind of everything is being reduced to what can fit on a smartphone screen because that's where people are getting their news. And I think that's going to go on for quite a while now.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to all three of you for joining us on Ballot Talks and Radio Times. Nicholas Carr, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, he writes about technology and culture. He wrote a book called The Shallows. The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. He's got a forthcoming book, Utopia is Creepy, and again, a contributor to Politico, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. Ken Winnick, thank you for joining us as well.
You're very welcome. Had a great time.
Great time for us as well. The managing director of survey research that's at the Annenberg Public Policy Center, a lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication, in fact, teaches a course on new media and politics. And Bruce Hardy, thank you for joining us as
well. You're
welcome. Rounding out our trio of guests, an assistant professor in the Department of Strategic Communication at Temple University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.